John Webb McMurray burst out of Hattiesburg, Mississippi in the mid-80s and landed in Nashville as Webb Wilder, leading the charge of the insurgent country roots rock scene that birthed the likes of Jason and Scorchers, Georgia Satellites, and Uncle Tupelo. Since then, he's released over a dozen albums, hosted his own radio show, narrated audiobooks, and toured relentlessly. His current tour in support of his latest record, Hillbilly Speedball, brings him to the streets of downtown Rhinelander, thanks to WXPR and Music Makes a Difference. I recently had the pleasure of chatting with Mr. Wilder about the new record and a few other things, and it went a little something like this. The human cannonball, the idol of idle youth, Mr. Webb Wilder, the last of the full-grown men.
Thanks for that great introduction.
Webb, it's a pleasure to talk to you, and we're so looking forward to you coming here in July. Let's get right down to talking about the brand new record. New record's called Hillbilly Speedball. Like an awful lot of your catalog, the one record covers a lot of stylistic ground. I mean, Hillbilly Speedball is pretty much some straight up rock and roll, and then this beautiful swampy blues from V8 Ford. And then all of a sudden, in the middle of the record, you have this gorgeous Beatles-esque high art piece that is putting on a show, and it's got like Shakespeare references.
Thanks for seeing it that way.
I absolutely do. And that's a lot of ground to cover. I guess that is the definition of hybrid vigor.
Yeah.
Can you tell us how you approach making a record? I mean, do you write for the record? Do you write and select songs in the moment, or do you have like a vast library of tunes and ideas that you go to and flesh out and then track order into an album?
All of the above, really. Paul McCartney once said, people ask him how to write a song. He says he doesn't know and he hopes he never finds out. So I just kind of follow the breadcrumbs. So there's got to be a starting point, you know, and I figure if I see what we get on the first couple of sessions, I know which way the album's going to go. And then I start, you know, summoning whatever ideas I may have had previously for a direction of that ilk and see what I've got that I'm writing, or see if I get inspired, or if you're going to do some covers, maybe do them first and hope you can write something by the time your money's gone or something, you know. And that's all of what happened on this album. The way it really started was my, you know, you hear people use the phrase my dear friend a lot. Mm-hmm. And they mean it. That's the thing. It's a cliche, but it's true if you're speaking of a dear friend. David Grissom is a dear friend of mine of many years and literally one of the greatest guitar players in the world and a great songwriter. And years ago, I recorded one of his songs, and we've known each other for decades, called Loud Music.
Yeah.
And we stayed in touch even more frequently during the pandemic, I guess, you know, because we were trapped in our respective homes in Austin and Nashville. And at some point, I guess just after that, because we worked on this album maybe a year and a half, or I don't want to admit it if we worked on it 2 years, but, you know, in dribs and drabs, mainly on Thursdays, to tell you the truth. But anyway, he said, I got this song and I want your opinion on it. So he sent me Hillbilly Speedball, and it was just his vocal and an acoustic guitar. And I said, man, I think it's great. What do you think about me doing it? And he said, great, the more the merrier. And it happens to be in the key of A flat, which is where some of my greatest quote unquote successes have resided, like Human Cannonball and Tough It Out. And so, and so next thing you know, we're making an album. So another one of my dear friends of many decades, of course, is George Bradfute. And, you know, he's been in and out of my band and on my records. And, you know, we're just close since, I don't know, I met him in 1986. And so we co-produced the album in his studio. And we started with David's song, Hillbilly Speedball. And then one thing led to another. And I'm so glad you like putting on a show, because it really is the arty, not everybody's gonna like it. I'm pleased and surprised, though, that the feedback on it has been much better than I thought, because on other albums, if I've leaned a little heavily into the balladry and a little away from the rock and roll, people haven't, as the Brits say, twigged to it as much. We were playing a show in East Tennessee one time, I think, and the Night Without Love album had come out, which has some rock and roll on it.
Oh yeah.
And this guy said, you know, I got your last album and there ain't too many rockers on there. And I wanted to say, like, well, how many you need? What's it take? I blame the Beatles, you know. It's like, I always liked music even before the Beatles, and I was in the fourth grade when the Beatle thing happened, but variety. They did Yesterday and Long Tall Sally. I thought that's the mark of a good record, you know, but by the time I started making records, that's not what the labels wanted. Therefore, that's not what people are used to anymore. You know, like marketing came into play. You do this. It's this kind of widget. We're marketing this. We're pushing this. You know.
Yeah, something that they can define and fit into a slot rather than, yeah, this is music.
I just thought, I mean, some people are born to play the blues, and they should. You know, some people are just born to be honky-tonk country artists, and they should be bluegrass, whatever. But my perception of what it took to at least aspire to be cool was to kind of have a grasp and an affinity for, if not an expertise, in all of it, you know, and know about it, you know, as much as possible, and combine those roots in my favorite into something of your own, hopefully, and or your own style, even if you don't write it. And my favorite artists have roots and have gone somewhere of their own with them.
Well, everything enriches everything else.
Yeah. That... And anything that's baseless is baseless.
Yeah. Yeah. I like having that, you know, just this little deviation. And like you were saying about the Beatles, they'd go all over the place. In the same record. Yeah.
And weren't they the gold standard? Aren't they still?
I think they're still the gold standard. I think that's fair to say. But it's a bit of a palate cleanser or whatever, you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Rocking out. And now, hey, check out this other thing here. And
well, even when you first start playing in bands for dances, like I did at the Teen Center, they wanted some slow songs to dance to, right?
Yeah, I got to have something to
you
make
You got to have some slow songs. So, yeah.
Yeah. You know, with the current music consumption and distribution landscape lately seems to be like individual songs or EPs or really not a lot of focus on putting together a full album. Is that tracking order? Is that, you know, something that sounds like that's something that you still find valuable and worthy of, you know, spinning out?
Yeah, it's kind of like, for me, it's kind of like, you know, be a good person even when nobody's watching. You know, it's like to, or at least to aspire to it. So it's, if it's important to me, I do it. So yeah, the sequencing is important to me. And I still think of music. Music primarily now exists in the virtual realm, recorded music in the virtual realm. But I don't think of it that way. But the funny thing is, you still can sell some CDs. And I still listen to CDs because I've got an old car. That was the thing that messed that up, was the new cars. Yeah.
Yes.
But what's weird is when you try to give one away to somebody and they won't take it because they don't have a CD player.
Yeah. And I go to shows and I'm like scraping all the CDs off the merch table. And it's like, yeah, that's cool. You have vinyl. Vinyl is nice. I like vinyl. Still can't play it in my car.
Right. And we have both. And we have both, and people buy both. And I'm trying to encourage them, not discourage them.
Right.
So if they want to, you know, and hear it another way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like sequencing because I grew up valuing music at a time when, if you valued music, the album as art form was king.
Yeah. Yeah. And you had the visual component along with the audio. And you
the visual, the sequencing, component. All was part of, you know, sort of equally important, you know.
Yeah. And now, you know, yes, I still buy plenty of vinyl, and it's and it almost seems like a lot of places that has gotten lost too. You know, okay, good. Now I've got the big cover, but man, I miss liner notes.
I have drifted away from the side one, side two mentality, which, you know, used to think of, that was like a subset of sequencing, you know.
Yeah.
And Michael Rothschild, who I love dearly, who's put out more Webb Wilder albums than anybody else on his Landslide label. We made a quick decision on how to divide them up. We just got on this record because I thought it sort of worked. We just kind of said, well, you know, cut it in the middle. It's 10 songs, put the first five on side A and the second five. And, you know, I think it does work. I don't know that there would be a better sequence for vinyl, but mainly what I think of is from beginning to end. And, you know, probably I'm, I'll admit it. I'm probably just CD oriented.
Yeah. Now, did I read somewhere that this is the first, that Hillbilly Speedball is your first vinyl release in a really long time, like since Hybrid Vigor back in
No, I wouldn't
the
blame somebody for thinking that because the previous album was disserved, if that's the word, was served poorly by the
I
pandemic.
was going to say
You
that
know,
was bad timing on the release.
that was April of 2020, right? So,
Yeah.
Night Without Love, which also has the fabulous Flournoy Holmes artwork, was the first vinyl album since '89.
That was okay. That
So
was
this is the
way
second
above.
one in a row we've had vinyl on.
Okay, cool. Speaking of this one, you close the record with the last song, the song called "The Last Song I'll Ever Sing." And
Yeah, it just keeps on in my mind justifying itself with tons of iconic cred in the roots music world because
that was a Joe Carson song.
let me tell you something. I had never heard of Joe Carson. And folks, if you've never heard of Joe Carson, he's the greatest country singer you never heard
Yes.
of. So here's my story on that. I think it was about the time. See, I've been buying albums since I was about nine or something. I had Ricky Nelson's Million Sellers and Elvis Presley. It happened at the World's Fair before the Beatles. Okay. My mother ordered them for me from Sears Roebuck. So I bought, the Mr. Tambourine Man album when I was 12, when that was a big hit, right? And so I remember going to Gibson's Discount Center, which was a bike ride away from my Hattiesburg, Mississippi suburban home, and flipping through the records. And I think I had bought the Turn, Turn, Turn single. So I saw the album and I thought, well, I guess I ought to buy that. I don't know. I just got a little bit of money here. I'm just a kid, spoiled as I am. I'm not rolling in dough. And I said, oh, the Everly Brothers. Because I knew they were cool and I knew those black guitars were cool. And I'm looking at them looking cool on this album cover. But what it was the Everly Brothers sing great country hits. But the last song I'm ever going to sing, I don't think was ever a hit by anybody, but it's on there.
No,
And
and
I
it
just,
was a song about it not being a hit.
and it was kind of a shoot the bird to the industry song with, and the way the Everlys do it, it's real sad, bitter lyric with a happy feel. So I just wanted to do it, and that's the way I thought it was. So my neighbor and friend and one of the greatest musicians and producers around is the great Richard Bennett. And he records at George's too, and so we've all known each other for years. And he was on the last album before this too, with a Los Lobos cover that I did. And anyway, so he goes, oh, have you heard the Joe Carson version? I'm like, who's Joe Carson? And so that was really cool because we kind of came up with our own version, being aware of all of them. So we liked the electric guitar on Joe Carson's. We liked lowering the key and making it more manly country. And we liked the acoustic guitars on the Everlys. And Richard put in a lot of time on this. He came over to my house twice and we just loved hanging out with him in the studio. He played on putting on a show too. He played that great acoustic 12-string solo,
Oh, cool. I
which
never
is
thought of
like
that.
saying it all with an economy of notes like only somebody of his caliber could do. So anyway, he had a lot to do with the recording. He played that cool flat wound string electric guitar part and tic tac bass, and he and I both played acoustics, and George engineered it and played upright bass. So yeah, that was fun. I love that song.
Yeah, and
And
I love
as
the
it
way you
turns out,
played
it's
it
written
in.
by two of the Crickets.
Right. Right,
Yeah.
yeah. And I've heard Carson's version or Joe Carson's version. Well, do you know about Joe Carson, the story behind that song? 'Cause that was the last song he ever sung in
Oh,
public.
'cause he died in a car wreck at like 26.
26, 27, something like that, shortly after that. And so not to say the song's cursed, or I'm not going to say the song's cursed.
Oh yeah. Well, Sonny Curtis, as far as I know, is alive and
Is
doing
still
well.
right, yeah, and you're doing
And
fine.
J.I. Allison lived a mighty long time, and they wrote it.
But yeah, I really love how your treatment of it. It doesn't, it's not, it's less maudlin than like the Joe Carson version, but it's got some good sweat on it. It's got
Yeah.
sweat on it that's missing in the Everly Brothers. So,
It's so hip that you know about Joe Carson because I'll admit I did not. And then it turns out, Bear Family did a box set on him and all that.
I will admit I just recently got twigged to Joe Carson in the last, I don't know, 6 or so months, thanks to a friend of mine who is a folklorist and has, among other things, written a book on Stardate Records. And
Oh, okay.
he informed Nate Gibson informed me of the whole story of, the last song and how it turned out for Joe Carson.
Well, that's interesting that you mentioned books too, because as I said, I heard it as a 12-year-old or something or younger by the Everly Brothers. And as fate would have it, I'm a talker and a singer, right? So I've done some audio books. I did a Johnny Cash book and a John Carter Cash book and a Doug Seeger's book and a Willie Nelson book.
I've got
So
that
I
all
ran
English
into.
book on reserve at the library, by
Oh,
the
good.
way, the
And these are the audiobooks. I didn't write them or anything. So
audiobook.
I ran into Barry Mazur, who is an astute musicologist, author, and he said he was doing a biography on the Everly Brothers. And I said, well, I've done a bunch of these. I've read a bunch of these. I'm the narrator on a bunch of these music books. Next thing you know, I had the gig. So that's coming out soon. And it's called Blood Harmony.
Oh, and you'll be narrating that.
Yeah, and I don't think there was ever really a proper biography on them. So this is really thorough, and you get the personal and professional stuff. And I think those guys, were great. I mean, I've never stopped thinking they were great, but I think it was a tough thing to be kind of a child performer and a teenage pop star and stuck with your brother, but like joined at the hip 24 hours a day.
They got a lot thrown at them. Well, what was being thrown at them was still being invented.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's a lot to take in. You're right. And well, like you mentioned, that particular song, that is one of the first anti-Nashville, I think it's the first anti-Nashville song that I can think of. I mean, now there's at least one whole album of that stuff, but
Yeah, and I love Nashville, and I never really tried to become any kind of music row recording artist. I had major label deals, none of which were out of here. It's just I loved the song, and we all have met with some scorn from or indifference from the powers that be.
Yeah, I mean, it's normal to hate on your boss. So
Yeah. Well, it's kind of the man, I don't know. It's just like some got to win, some got to lose, and like Tom Petty said, even the losers get lucky
get lucky
sometimes. So
sometimes.
it's a song that raises a glass to the losers.
Hey, I want to talk about the Credo, because every time I play a Webb Wilder tune, and I know I have a colleague here at WXPR, every time he plays a Webb Wilder tune, we have to recite the Credo. It's compulsory,
All
and
right.
it says, work hard, rock hard, eat hard, sleep hard, grow big, wear glasses if you need them. And I can attest, all except, well, the grow big thing didn't quite work out for me so well, but I subscribe to all of those things, and
Eat hard may not be the best advice I could ever give someone.
well, every artist doesn't have a credo, at least one that they publicized. How did that come about?
I know exactly how it came about, and it came right out of my own head, but it might not have if it hadn't been for R.S. Field, who I always know as Bobby Field, who I grew up with in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, who had a lot to do with my music career and my life. His mother was my first Sunday school teacher, even though I have no memory of it. And I've known him since I was like 14 at least. And he is a mad genius. And he was the original drummer in the Beatniks, And so he came to Nashville. I was in a band in Mississippi that he had a lot to do with and wrote for and stuff called the Drapes. And a songwriter, another Mississippi songwriter who had had some success here in Nashville named Dan Tyler, loved the songs. And I just kind of moved to Nashville on a wing and a prayer on hoping, I could do something based out of somewhere that was better to be at than Hattiesburg, Mississippi. And then Dan had some success and gave put the money into hiring Bobby as a publishing deal as a writer. So he came to Nashville. He didn't want to play drums. He had been a drummer and a writer and everything. And but he went to Austin to write with our other old Mississippi pal, Kent Omar Dykes. This is early in the early 80s, and saw David Grissom. play guitar fabulously with Lou Ann Barton, and came back like a changed man, because he always loves great guitar players and has used David on a lot of the other records he's produced, and said, "I'll be your drummer." So we started working on this whole thing. And by, you know, that was like in 84, but, and we started playing in March of 85, and by November of 85, he quit. But he found Jimmy Lester, who's Keith Moonshine, who's a great drummer. But anyway, in the interim, we were taking our first out-of-town trip in a terrible six-cylinder van with a three-speed manual transmission on the Natchez Trace going to Jackson, Mississippi. And so we had one of those boom boxes that you could push the buttons and record on, and it would compress the sound. It was great to record your rehearsals on. And Bobby, being the producer, mad genius he is, he said, "Let's simulate an interview. These are early days." He goes, "You know, you're going to be interviewed, and you might as well, you know, get your feet wet and everything." So he asked me a series of questions, none of which I remember. But then he said, "Is there anything else you'd like to add?" And I don't know why, but it came to me, and I just went right in real time: work hard, rock hard, eat hard, sleep hard, grow big, wear glasses if you need them, the Web Wilder credo. And it's probably, you know, partially because I wear glasses justifies it. Yeah.
Although, yeah, you don't want too many people to grow too big in a van.
No, no.
In a van.
But if you eat hard and sleep hard, you'll grow big.
You'll grow big. You go to bed. Yeah. There is that.
But yeah, you know, there were those sampler albums in the 70s that Warner and Reprise put out, Big Ball and Record Show, and there was a guy named Stan Kornan, I think, behind him, and you'd get like the GTOs and Captain Beefheart and the Faces and Jethro Tull on one record, you know?
Yeah.
And there was this guy named Ed Sanders who'd been in the Fugs, F-U-G-S.
Yeah, right. I know the Fugs, yeah.
And he had a song where the guy had a novelty song. It was Johnny Piss Off, if you can say that on the radio. And he had the Jonathan Abner Tobias Piss Off Credo. Check it out. It's pretty crazy.
Yes, absolutely. So, hey, look it. I have a question that I got from one Web Wilder, because he asked Joe Williams, "What are your favorite songs that you ever recorded?"
I did ask him that, and that was a moment too. You know, some of the ones that are my favorite ones to record aren't necessarily the ones that are the most popular with fans, because it's kind of two different things, you know. Like, which one was the most fun one to record? Like, we had such a special time recording with Richard Bennett. You know, that was great.
Yeah.
But I have a soft spot in my heart for a song that is another one of those arty ballad kind of songs called Fall in Place, that Bobby Field and Susie Elkins, who just had a birthday, wrote. And it's, what album is it on? It must be on the Acres of Suede album. Mm. And I always really liked Every Day I Kick Myself, which Bobby and I wrote on the Doodad album.
Yeah.
And I really like our cover. It's not that my vocal is so stellar, but the track and the mood of it, of Mata Hoople's original Mixed Up Kid.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's kind of one of them.
And our cover of Slow Death by the Flamin' Groovies, which sounds great on the radio. I got to hear it on the radio in Bowling Green. Yeah.
I think I have played that on the radio, and I think I've actually backed it with the Groovies version of it, because, yeah, they stand up with each other very, very well. And I'm a huge Groovies fan. So.
Oh, yeah. On the new album, it was really a pleasure to finally finish writing after many years, a couple of good moves, and to record that and have it turn out good. And now we're getting great feedback on it. So
Dan Baird had something to do with that, right?
Yeah, it was a conversation I was having with him. This is how slow I am on songwriting sometimes. Mm-hmm. In 1989.
Dan Baird from Satellites.
Yeah, yeah, because the Satellites had the big hit. And then we had the same management, and we finally had a major deal. And so we were on a tour, and I don't even know why I was on their bus, unless maybe it was a thing where you and Dan need to be together because you're going to both be interviewed for, you know, some, I don't know. So Dan is never lacked confidence. He's literally driving the tour bus through the night. And I don't know what the other guys are doing. And I'm sitting up there in the shotgun seat with him, 1989, when the Hybrid Vigor album first came out. And I'm talking to him, and we're just shooting the breeze about all kind of stuff. And I don't know why it came to me. And I said, Man, have you ever seen that Burt Lancaster movie, Elmer Gantry? And he said, "Oh yeah, you should see that. That gave you a couple of new moves," or something like that. And somehow that stuck in my mind. And I think it was years later I started trying to write the song. And then we had a, you know, we had five or six maybe of these cuts under our belt on this album. And I thought, man, maybe I could finish that thing. And I thought, it needs a chorus. And it was like a gift. As soon as I had the chorus, I had the bridge. And then I put down some temporary kind of lyrics and went and cut the vocal. And there was only one line that bothered me, and George wouldn't let me change it. So it was, I rationalized finally, it's like when John Lennon told Paul McCartney. Paul McCartney said, "I'm going to change that line on Hey Jude about the moment you need is on your shoulder," or whatever. And Lennon, of course, this is weird. He said, "That's the best line in your song." I don't know if that's true. But anyway, it kind of came together. So there you go.
So, okay. Sometimes a song needs to marinate for 40 years. Okay.
Yeah, the gestation was a long one.
What are you listening to these days?
Well, I listen to a variety of things that we play on MOT, on WMOT in the car, you know. So I'm hearing, well, let's see who's on. I just recorded my show for tomorrow, and Kathleen Edwards is a Canadian. She does that Tired of Traveling Jason Isbell song with him. That's good. That's not on the show, but that's good. But actually, you know, outside of radio, I tend to listen to older stuff, you know, like I have the I saw the Faces in 71 before Rod Stewart became what he became. And when he was someone I admired as an artist. And anyway, they just changed my life. You know, I've got the Ron Wood bobblehead. I got to know Mac, you know. So they put Late in the Game, it had never been released. The early 70s live at the BBC Faces stuff is fantastic. And I've been listening to those discs. And, just last night they re-aired that CBS Grammy salute to Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys.
Oh,
And
sure.
man, Abe Laborial Jr., McCartney's drummer, who sings like an angel and plays drums like a god, was the house band drummer. And everything was that excellent,
Oh, my
with a
God.
variety of artists, you know, doing Brian Wilson songs. And now I had seen it before, but since he just died, they played it again. They must have rehearsed their butts off for it. And what's the guy's name? Luke Spiller from the Struts. And
Luke Spiller.
Taylor Mopsen, is that her name, from Pretty Reckless? They were
Sounds right.
great, man. So I've been thinking about that all day.
Say, since you will be coming to town the 19th of July, you'll be coming to Rhinelander. What is your touring lineup these days? What are there? Is there still a Nash Vegans or Beatniks, or who is the
I
band?
try to not use either one of those names anymore because probably they apply to different people. Also, nobody ever got the names right. You know, like you just said, God knows, with no disrespect, you said Nash Vegans. Well, we wanted it to be Nash Vegans. It's a
Vegans.
play on Las Vegas, Nash Vegas.
Nash Vegas.
See, and Beatniks always got pronounced Beatniks, and there's like no irony there. You know, I said, we're
No,
not
it's
Maynard G.
Beatniks.
Krebs, you know. You know, so yeah, I try to not do that. And we've been touring as a trio, you know, and so it's Ralph Friedrichsen, who played for many years with Paul Thorne on bass and backing vocals, and Marshall Richardson, who's on several songs on the new album. Ralph hadn't really been in the camp while we were recording the album, or he probably would have been. But Marshall plays on Couple of Good Moves, Allergic to Love, and Putting on a Show. And funny enough, I found out, I knew about Carl Perkins made the album with NRBQ years ago, and that's how I knew about Allergic to Love. But Joe Carson had a song called I'm Not Allergic to Love.
Yes, he did. Wow. Yeah. Okay. There's something I get to put into my next show.
Yeah.
Do you get hired, session musicians when you're doing a record as opposed to the band you tour with, or
It
by and large?
it's really a case by case thing. You know, you could talk about which album. You know, it was a real mixture of this. Although I've been here so long, you know, they're all friends of mine, and many of them have played my band. Like, you know, Greg Morrow and Jimmy Lester are the drummers on Doodad. Well, they both played on this album. You know, Brian Owings toured with me for years. He's on this album. So we have a lot of great drummers. We have Marshall and Brian and Greg and Jimmy. George is like a Renaissance man who can play anything. And he played, just because he's sitting there, I'm there with him. He played, you know, bass on all but one song. And then Tom Comet, who played with me live for years and on record, sang some harmony on some songs. And he played bass on Kick Me When I'm Down. Yeah. George played a lot of things. I mean, he played guitar, he played bass, he played a little keyboard, played stand-up and electric bass. This is the first album I've ever played acoustic 12-string on, and I think I did it on two different songs. Bob Williams, who's a great guitar player, but kind of like George, can play anything, played, you know, dobro and mandolin and pedal steel on Sorrow, which Vince Gill sang harmony on. Come on.
Yeah. That was a coup. Getting Vince Gill.
He is the most down-to-earth superstar in the world.
That's super cool to hear. That's
super cool. Talent, super guy.
Wow. That's awesome to hear, because, you know.
It ain't always the case.
No. So, as I mentioned, you're playing here, and the show will be to kick off WXPR's summer membership drive. And, of course, WXPR is an independent community radio station. And we, you know, we're in a little town, but we serve a geographically very large rural area, and we get like hundreds of thousands of visitors annually because it's a tourist destination. And so I, you know, it's no secret that public radio is, and community radio is, in a bit of an existential crisis right now. And so, yeah, I'd like to ask you, what has the community and public radio, you know, independent radio, meant for you and for indie artists generally?
Well, as an artist, it's meant a lot because, you know, after a certain point, I mean, I think our first airplay was on college radio here in Nashville on Vanderbilt Radio, you know, but, you know, then we went on to the two major deals, you know, and you were really going for album-oriented rock radio, and you wanted public radio and college radio and everything you could get, too. But then those days were over, and really that's sort of it, you know, maybe a little triple A radio, which the public doesn't even know what that means, and I'm not sure I can define it, but it's meant a lot. And then, of course, as a part-time job, you know, it's meant a whole lot to me as a DJ, because that's my other gig, and I can thank Jesse Scott for my radio opportunities. You know, because of her, I can, what do they say, it ain't bragging if you done it, I can say I was literally one of the first satellite DJs. I mean, if they hire you before they even go on the air, that makes you one of the first. And that's what happened to me with XM before XM and Sirius merged. And so I did that for 4.5 years, and everybody pretty much got laid off. And about 10 years later, she called me to do this on public radio, WMOT. So as an artist and as a vocation, it's meant the world to me. Maybe. And I get airplay. I mean, you know, I'm one of the many artists who get airplay on WMOT. So, yeah.
And
elsewhere.
Yeah, on WXPR.
which I'm very grateful for. So, yeah, it's a drag. You know, I think there are those people who think the government shouldn't fund anything. And I always want to ask them, like, so you don't want a fire department? You don't want a police department? You don't
see
the
validity. How did you get to this show?
Yeah, and I think there are those people who see public radio and public TV as some kind of commie thing or something, which is ridiculous. I mean, public TV, for instance, that's where you find out about nature and science and history and music
and the alphabet.
You know, it's like taking music out of the schools. It's like, do you just value no culture at all? What are you thinking here?
Last question, and I think this one is probably just for my gratification, because I collect the answers, and I think I know the answer to this one because I think you answered it. But what was the first record you ever bought with your own money?
With my own money is tough since I was such a spoiled only child, you know. Like I say, my mother, I know, paid for those first two albums. But I'll tell you what I think it might have been, though, because I got an allowance and all this kind of thing. You know, I always tell people the Deep South is an Afro-Celtic culture. I mean, even Bo Diddley had a Mac in his last name. He was Ellis McDaniel. So my best friend was Paul McDaniel. He lived down the street. And his dad was from the same town as Bo Diddley, Macomb, Mississippi. I mean, he lived in Hattiesburg, of course.
Whoa.
So it was Mac everything. There was Mac, everybody was Mac something. And so anyway, Paul McDaniel and I, we could ride our bikes to a shopping center. And the South has such wonderful stuff. You know, you don't have to make it up where the Jitney Jungle grocery store was, you know, and the Seal Lily ice cream parlor. And we were in the
Oh,
Ben Franklin dime store, Five and Dime.
yeah.
And looking at the 45s.
Those
And
still exist, by the way. I found one in Upper Michigan.
was it a Ben Franklin?
Honest to God, Ben Franklin. Yeah, there aren't many,
Wow.
but I have found one.
I haven't seen one in years. We had Morgan and Lindsay, and we had Ben Franklin and Woolworths, I guess, which is a different thing. But anyway, so we're looking at the 45s, and what we were looking at was the Searchers, who had had the big hit with Needles and Pins. We're looking at their cover of High Heel Sneakers. And of course, the original by Tommy Tucker is the bomb, but I didn't know that as a 9-year-old or 12-year-old or whatever it was. So anyway, I took his word for it that it was good. And it was good. I liked it, you know. High Heel Sneakers by the Searchers. And later I recorded High Heel Sneakers.
Yes, that was the Searchers tune.
But ours isn't like the Searchers. The reason I started doing it, I guess, is kind of knew the words to it. And years ago we were playing in Paris. Sometime in the 90s, and all the girls were wearing what you could call high heel sneakers. They were like these platform kind of sneakers.
Platform
And
sneak,
we started playing it, just everybody knew it. We just started playing it in the club. And then I found an old live cassette and I thought, oh, we could put that. So that's on the, I guess that's on the Night Without Love album.
Well, Webb, I want to thank you ever so much for hanging out and chatting with me and chatting with the listeners. Folks, you are in for a show, in case you haven't figured it out. As I mentioned before, it's on the 19th of July, right here in downtown Rhinelander at Art Start. If the weather gods smile on us, it will be outside, and we're gonna open her up. And yes, it is a free show featuring Webb Wilder and also featuring Mama Ginger and the Red Hots.
That's 6 p.m. Saturday, July 19th. Go to wxpr.org for more information, and thanks for listening.